Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Lots going on. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages of the papers. So, Grok obviously still everywhere. The Business Post is leading with EU to investigate Grok, as Harris says, safety trumps tech money, right? So the European Commission is expected to launch a formal investigation into X this week following controversy over non-consensual AI nudified images. They also have Simon Harris insisting that tackling the perverse use of Grok is more important than European relations with US big tech. He said, if we have a situation now where there's child abuse imagery circulating around the European Union, there are some things clearly more important than money, he says. The Sunday Times also leading with this story, and they are saying that Gardaí have begun pursuing preservation orders on X. So what that means is that they are requesting that the tech company retain all data linked to the creation of alleged child abuse images generated through Grok. They also have that story that broke overnight, Trump imposing tariffs on NATO allies over Greenland. So on Truth Social, which is where diplomacy is done these days, he says a 10% import tax will start next month. And it's time for Denmark to give back, he says. The Sunday Independent, Trump Fed battle risk mother of all global recessions. I know, as if you didn't have enough to be dealing with. This is Dr. Alan Ahern, who Niamh Horan wrote this piece, points out, predicted the 2008 crash and worked at the Fed for 7 years. And he was also an advisor to the government here. He said that if Donald Trump succeeds in taking control of the Fed, which is the US central bank, essentially, and as we know, central banks are independent of government and guard that independence carefully. He says if this happens, it could rock confidence in the US bond market. The outcome would be worse than anything experienced in the last economic downturn. He's not saying that is going to happen, by the way, and we're a long way from it, and there's significant pushback. OK, so don't panic yet. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Lord of the Dance is mine. It will not be taken from me. That's what Michael Flatley is saying. That is an ongoing legal row over the control of that show, Lord of the Dance. The Irish Sun on Sunday has Margaret Loftus, and you will have seen during the week, Margaret Loftus, who was a former Garda herself, suffered a terrifying attack from her husband, Trevor Balger, also a guard. She has saying here that she's told how her ex-husband did his best to break me, and she said he should be in jail for a terrifying assault on her 13 years ago. We saw that he got a suspended sentence of 3 months. The Mirror is leading with the fact that transgender sex offender Barbie Kardashian had to be moved to the male facility at Limerick Prison over vile threats to child killer Tegan McGee. And The Observer, just to give you a flavour of international papers, of the English papers, blackmail over Greenland. Donald Trump puts rising tariffs on the UK and European allies until he gets control of Danish territory. And the UK taking this one particularly badly, as we would if it was happening to us. But, you know, they were kind of portraying themselves as winners in the tariff thing and everything, and they felt that all Keir Starmer sucking up to Trump had worked, but there you go. Now, our panel this morning, Breed Smith, is a Ballyfermot community activist and a former People Before Profit TD. Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at the University of Galway. Oisín Coughlin is a public policy advisor. And Ellen Coyne is political correspondent at the Irish Times. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
If you put on your headphones first, and we're joined now by the former Irish ambassador to the US, Dan Mulhall. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Dan, it feels sometimes these days as if the Rubicon is far behind us in the rearview mirror. But it feels, is this another Rubicon being crossed? Because essentially, Donald Trump is exercising economic power, tariffs, against his allies. OK, he's done that before in the interests of economic war. He is now doing it in the furtherance of war, to take over a country, invade a country that is also one of his allies. Is this completely unprecedented territory we're into now?
Yes. I mean, certainly since the Second World War, look, Europe has benefited hugely from the stability provided by the NATO alliance over the last 75 years. And frankly, it seems to me that that alliance is kind of winding down at this stage. I mean, it's one thing, I think for a while now, there's been doubts about whether Donald Trump would really be willing to go to war to defend Europe, but, threaten to take over the territory of a European ally, a NATO ally, and then yesterday going even further by actually threatening to impose tariffs on European countries that actually support international law and Denmark's sovereignty over Greenland. So
is America gone rogue, Dan? Do we have to call a spade at this stage? Is it now an enemy of the liberal democratic world that we think we live in?
Look, that may be the case, but I don't think we need to go that far at this stage. Look, I believe the European Union probably had to try to sort of manage the Trump phenomenon. And, they bowed the knee on tariffs. They accepted a 15% tariff, which was a suboptimal outcome to those trade negotiations. You saw NATO bowing the knee again, paying homage to him and so forth. But unfortunately, that hasn't yielded a permanent, a settled relationship between the European Union and the United States.
Is it time to show a bit of backbone then?
Yeah, I think this is a milestone moment because I think that because now who could believe that the United States would be willing to stand behind the NATO guarantee? So I don't think that Europeans are going to throw the NATO alliance out the window, but I do think that there has to be some kind of tougher response this time around softly hasn't worked.
Okay, so what leverage do we have for a tougher response here? Is it trade measures against the US?
Yeah.
Which would be shooting ourselves in the foot. What is it?
Look, this latest development is clearly a move to use trade policy to punish those European countries that support Denmark. Now, I think the European Union will have to respond this time. I don't think the European Union could accept this kind of move by the United States and just take it lying down. I think that would be a very, very bad signal to give because it would suggest that the European Union can roll over in any circumstances. So I think it's going to be a very tough conversation in Brussels because, Brussels is not like America. There is no central power in Brussels. You have to get the agreement of 27 member states. The Commission is involved, the Council Secretaries. So a lot of people are involved in this discussion, but I find it hard to believe will be anything less than some kind of equivalent response by the European Union to try to show the Americans that this is not easy street for them. Now,
but it's
I'm
interesting
also
what
that there
you
will
say,
be a reaction
Larry,
in the United
or,
States.
Or Dan, sorry, Dan. Interesting what you say there, though, about Europe, right? Are we dealing with one guy who can unilaterally decide and stick it out on a tweet or a Truth Social or whatever he calls it and act as instantaneously as that versus a bunch of bungling countries led by a slow-moving bureaucracy that is its head is spinning with every new thing that happens and it takes ages to respond? Now, I noticed that Paul Cunningham is reporting that a European Parliament Vice President, Siegfried Murasan, has said that three groups in the Parliament, the European People's Party, Progressives and Renew, will postpone the ratification of the EU-US trade deal due to this.
Look, I mean, as I said, there's no easy solutions here, but I find it hard to believe that the European Union will just sit on its hands and do nothing, because I think to do that would actually lead to an even more cavalier approach. Now, I'm also hoping, by the way, that in the United States, that this particular move will provoke a reaction. Like I saw yesterday a joint statement by a Republican and a Democrat senator. Tom Tillis, senator from North Carolina, has spoken out against this. So has Lisa Murkowski. So the question is, are there three or four more Republican senators who'd be willing to say, this has to stop. We cannot stand over this wrecking of the NATO alliance. Because
the latest polling from CNN shows that 75% of people in the US are against the taking over of Greenland.
Yeah, but the key thing is, are there enough Republican senators willing to stand with the Democrats and to put a stop to Donald Trump's gallop on this particular issue? And I think this is such an extreme move that I think there's a reasonable chance that there will be pushback from Republican senators. Because the one area where the Republican Party, the traditional Republican Party, still exists is, I think, in the area of foreign policy, where these people like Mitch McConnell, have spent a lifetime being devoted exponents of the NATO alliance. And for them to suddenly turn their their backs on it and allow Donald Trump to take over Greenland and essentially wreck the NATO alliance, I think might be a bridge too far for them. But then again, you know, these people haven't shown too much courage over the last year or so. So the question is this a Rubicon for them? I think it's a Rubicon for Europe, frankly. Is it a Rubicon for the domestic checks and balances that are supposed to apply within the American system?
Dan Mulhall, former Irish ambassador to the US, thank you very much for taking that call this morning. Larry Donnelly, I suppose we could hope that there might be a taco element to this, like that this is a idle threats.
We could hope so, but I think, you know, Venezuela, I think, changed the equation in that on many respects. We are dealing with, I'm afraid there's no other word to put on it, we're dealing with madness. I mean, this is crazy. Donald Trump doesn't, for all the stated reasons he says we have to have Greenland, you don't need to acquire the country to do any of those things.
The Greenlanders are sitting there offering him, tell us whatever you want, militarily, minerals, trade, whatever you want, access, we'll give it to you.
Absolutely. And as you say, very few Americans are in favor of us taking Greenland. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever unless you go to the very negative conclusions that lots of people have drawn. And in fairness, their assessment of Donald Trump from a very early stage was better than mine, is that Trump is everything people have said. All the negative things that you can... That's the only explanation for this course of action. It makes no sense politically. It could cause the end of NATO. It's not good for his party as they face into the midterms. It literally, politically speaking, it makes zero sense.
Okay. Reed Smith, did you ever think you'd be wishing for the days of the good old-fashioned Republican neocons who at least operated in some kind of same logical universe as the rest of us?
I think we can all acknowledge that we're living in a period of intense rivalry, economic and military rivalry across the planet. And this is what this is all about. It's Trump reasserting the influence of America, the dominance of America, in, as he said, in the Western Hemisphere, which is why he went into Venezuela in the manner he did, which is why he's threatening most of Latin America and now taking on Greenland. He wants to dominate the Western Hemisphere and then be ready to take on his main rival, which is China, and in the hope of pulling Russia into his side, maybe or maybe not. But
and the funny thing is he's driving everyone into the arms of China by doing this. Like,
well, not
China,
really. I don't
China
see
is
European...
now viewed as a more stable partner than the US at the moment.
Absolutely, totally more stable and more rational.
Yeah.
And that's saying something. But I don't think the EU are going to stand up to them, unfortunately. I do not think so.
Are they capable of quick response in these situations?
Well, you see, I think if from the get-go, if you were going to stand up to a tyrant and what he's capable of, the EU should have taken the stronger stance on Gaza and the fact that the Americans were backing Netanyahu to the hilt on the genocide. They have not done that. And once you let that go, then all bets are off. And when he started imposing tariffs on Europe, they were all, okay, well, let's talk about this. Instead of actually standing up to him and taking on a stronger...
In what way, though?
How to stand up to him. Well, I mean, I don't agree with capitalist economics because I think they logically lead to where we're going now, which is imperial conflict that's going to bring us into another war. And it's interesting that
socialism has caused a fair few wars and
socialism
and despotism
has been a response
down
to
the
wars.
Years.
Socialism has never actually existed anywhere. In my book, it hasn't existed in Venezuela or in Cuba or in Russia or indeed in China. There's been attempts to have it, and the attempts have often been wiped out, but it hasn't actually had a chance to exist because it's been crushed by the rest of the system around it. Having said that, I do think
I mean,
that Dan
people
Mulhall
would argue that the socialists
something.
Themselves, once they got into power, often crushed it themselves.
Well, I think if you look back on what happened after the Russian Revolution, it wasn't Joseph Stalin emerged as an absolute tyrant and destroyed what had been created by the people who genuinely set out to free Russia of the Tsar and his tyranny. But so did 14 armies of the rest of the world surrounding the borders of Russia, insisting you were not going to create this kind of an economy here.
Okay.
So it's not that simple. But Dan Hall touched on something there when he said we haven't seen anything like this since the Second World War. And every time you turn on the radio you think, am I living in 1937 or 38 where more and more things are happening so fast, so quick, they're so dramatic and they're so threatening. And it's happening at the rate of knots right across the planet that I do think we're hurtling towards a major conflict, and it's all about inter-imperialist rivalry. It's about who dominates in the capitalist system, and in the course of doing so, there are absolutely destroying the planet and throwing the climate chaos that we were trying to deal with, throwing that agenda completely under the bus. So whatever chance we have of pulling together a planet that makes logical sense, that's built for people and that gives people hope for the future, we're not going to do it with these guys in charge.
Okay. Oisin, you picked the Sunday Times, which is this straight news report on this. I guess Trump imposes tariffs on NATO. Anyway, your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I think we have to conclude that the Europe is now in a hybrid war, both with Russia to our east and the US to our west. Between the we'll come on to the tech stuff, but that's a lot of that's coming from the west in the case of US companies, and from the east, it's coming in the form of misinformation. We'll admit they're both doing misinformation, but now we have had an incursion into European soil by Russia into Ukraine, and we're now having the US threatening to go into Greenland. And given what happened in Venezuela, as Lai said, you wouldn't be surprised if Trump preempts things by sending in troops in the next week or two. Even though, as you say, all of the treaties that they already have with Denmark and Greenland mean they could expand their bases, they could do all the things they say they want
to
do.
They have cut their military presence down, there, yes, by 99%.
So all of the things Trump says it's about could be dealt with, as Larry said, by existing treaties and agreements.
But he has said, it's psychological, we need to own
it. Like, well, I do think, I read somewhere not in today's papers, that basically it comes back to he wants to be a president that makes the US land bigger.
It's bigger.
Like German in the 1930s again.
Are we in a hybrid war with the US now? That's an alarming kind of a thought, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting increasingly difficult to deny it when you look at the aggressive posturing of this administration. I think it's really important to note the mindset of many people in this administration, including J.D. Vance, which is fundamentally anti-European. They don't like the social model in Europe. They reject it. They think it is a thing of the past. They think the United States has been carrying water for Europe for way too long and footing the bill.
And they think we're a bunch of socialists as well. And Breed would disagree,
there is an audience for that, and you know, and it's reflected in a new Wall Street Journal poll, which I find frankly astonishing. Despite everything we've seen and heard, a Wall Street Journal poll that came out just a couple of days ago, 92% of Donald Trump voters in 2024 give him a positive job rating. 70% of those strongly approve of his performance in office. So it is extraordinary.
There was a CNN poll over the weekend as well where his approval ratings are down around 40-41 and below 40 on things like immigration and everything.
That's the other side. 54%
of his voters abandoning him is enough to tip it the other way. Ellen, this is all very well. Not to be the skibbereen eagle about it, but what does it mean for us right now?
So I suppose, you know, people are waking up this morning and finding out that Donald Trump is trying to gain an island and lose the world at the same time. And while people will be scanning the newspapers and noticing that Ireland, obviously not as a NATO member, is not among the 8 nations that have been threatened with a 10% increase in tariffs in the interim, followed by a threatened 25% increase in the summer, this could affect all of us. Because if you listen to Simon Harris this morning, the finance minister will be travelling to Brussels tomorrow to have a meeting with his fellow EU finance ministers, and this is going to dominate discussions. This has threatened, and in Simon Harris's language, undermined work that was already done on a transatlantic trade agreement between the US and the EU to stave off the former threat of trade wars that we had from this American president. And Helen McEntee, in her statement this morning, is pointing out that this isn't really about NATO at all. This is about the core principles of the UN Charter, something that we have been signed up to since the 1950s, a charter that protects the sovereign rights of every country in the world, particularly small countries. And for the US to be able to undermine this, to dismiss foreign policy in such a brazen way, is a matter for Ireland, even if we're not a NATO
member.
So we
are inserting ourselves into this now.
Yes, I mean,
as an old wise colleague of mine used to say, do we really want to draw these people on us?
I don't think we have a choice. I think as a member of the European Union, this is not really the US against its NATO allies, although with allies with like America, who needs enemies? This is very much back in the frame of US and EU trade war, unfortunately.
Okay. Larry, just a kind of an interesting sidebar to this then. The Irish Times have been kind of nibbling away at this all week, and Mick Clifford had a good piece about it in the Examiner yesterday. But Matt Cooper is writing in the Business Post about this gathering that Eddie Hobbs had. The US ambassador was at it, and there's various talks about a kind of a local MAGA franchise now coming to Ireland.
Yeah, 300 or 400 people paid, I think, €90 to attend the event. And of course, we know that the political right in Ireland hasn't had much success. I mean, they just haven't had any really capable candidates, nor have they built a movement of any size, at least electorally speaking. But the issue remains. It's still out there. And one of the fascinating things that Matt Cooper points out is the fascination of the American right with Ireland and how it's always seems to be brought up. And some of that is down to FDI. Some of it's down to the transactions and undersea cables and all that sort of thing. But I actually think it's something bigger than that. And it is this idea that Ireland almost has become a cautionary tale among elements of the American right. That is, this country that was culturally conservative, that was Catholic, that was white, has now changed and has changed very rapidly. And now is a multicultural society, which, of course, they are not enamored of. And they are using Ireland almost as a case study to say, look, Ireland's going. This is a dangerous road to go down. I think that that is a potent message in the United States. Whether it will get many adherents here, I think, is doubtful. But at the same time, we do see that there is emergence of anti-immigrant sentiment. I mean, if you look at the polling on immigration, it's become almost an 80-20 issue. When you're asked the simple question, do you think we should take less immigrants? It's almost become an 80-20 issue. So I think monitoring that space is crucially important. And again, it is significant also, I think, that the U.S. ambassador was president. Of course, he is a Donald Trump appointee. His politics lean to the right. So in one way, it's no surprise. But nonetheless, it is a little bit startling.
Yeah. Bree, do you think, as the far right, did it have its moment here? And has the government pivoted sufficiently to kind of serve the people who had all those concerns?
Well, I mean, we'll probably come along to more of this discussion when we come to Grok and the role of AI. But really, the far right in this country barely existed before the algorithms sort of pushed people in that direction. Oh, my God, watch out. There's going to be a flood of immigrants. They're going to destroy the country. Oh, my God, they're going to take your babies from you. Everybody's going to have abortions.
Are you seeing young lads getting on board with this kind of thing in Ballyfermot?
And they're being targeted by the algorithms. Young lads in particular are being targeted by the algorithms to say, come on now, you'll be a hero if you go after these immigrants. You'll be a hero if you stand up for your country. And this has been proven. And it's really sad as well as very, very dangerous that this is happening. But I honestly don't believe, I mean, I am a community activist and I am out there and I know there's concerns about immigration, but there's far more concerns about, you know, the cost of living. How do we get a home? How do our kids get housed? And there's been an attempt to blame that.
Yeah, but I guess those concerns have been conflated.
They have been conflated, deliberately conflated by the far right, and it hasn't been helped by people like Simon Harris leaning into this rhetoric, because it is not true.
I think it's unfair to say he's leaned into hard right rhetoric.
He's leaned into the idea that immigration is a cause of the housing crisis. He has clearly leaned into that in recent weeks.
That it is one of the reasons.
But it isn't one of the reasons. It isn't. 160,000 empty properties lying around the country, lying derelict, is more of a reason
than anything
else.
Okay, that's another reason. But like the fact that there are a lot, like it's basic maths, is it not, that if there are a lot of people coming into this country, both as like asylum seekers, but also as people with work permits and everything else, that's going to put more pressure on the housing system.
Well, just on the last point, people with work permits and everything else, if they weren't coming, we wouldn't be able to open a nursing home or keep a hospital ward open. If they weren't coming, we wouldn't be able to build the future homes for people that we should be building and are building to a limited extent. So migration is a positive thing for this country. And the idea that all immigrants and asylum seekers are taking up homes is not true. They're put into hotels, they're put into empty spaces around the country, and they're put often and increasingly into sites that hold tents and people sleep in tents. They're not taking up the homes. Okay. It is true that there are more families who aren't Irish on the housing list and are allocated houses. But there are fewer and fewer people on the housing list getting off it anyway because of the housing policy in this country. We're not building enough public homes.
I think there are a lot of people getting off it, but there are more coming onto it, isn't there? Is that part
either of affordable or social housing, we're not building enough.
There's a couple of pieces that kind of speak to this. Ellen, Eoghan O'Malley is an interesting piece about research that he and other people have done on the last election.
Yeah, Oona Malley has a book coming out this week, How Ireland Voted 2024, which is a statistical and political analysis of the 2024 general election. And I think it kind of picks up on some of the points that, that Breed was making. But when they actually went through the manifestos of every party, and I know Breed won't agree with this, they found that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, according to this calculation, were actually parties of the left, even though 30% of voters, I think, would identify them as being on the right. And I suppose Oona Malley is making the point that does that mean that there is a political vacuum on a certain part of the spectrum that's not being served by the what used to previously be known as the two main parties. But I suppose knowing that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are capable as, of just as much populist tendencies as Sinn Féin, is that an indication that they're kind of following where the country actually sits? To pick up on what you were saying there, Breed, about Simon Harris, I was the one who did the interview with him over Christmas when he made those controversial comments claiming that there's a significant cohort of people in homelessness who do not have a housing right, meaning that there's people in homelessness who do not actually have a right to social housing. While it is absolutely a statistical fact that the proportion of non-nationals within our homeless population has increased over the last 3 years, and Focus Ireland have been very strong in this, I haven't yet actually been able to find any statistical evidence that people who do not have a right to long-term housing, so people who are going through IPAS but haven't had their application considered, or people from Ukraine, do represent a significant proportion of people who are seeking social housing who don't
and
actually
indeed,
have a right
nobody
to
nobody has a right to housing.
A fair point.
Country,
nobody.
Yeah.
Have, you have certain housing rights.
But and Mary Oisín, Hayes that pushed brings back us on that too. Mary Hayes, who heads up the housing executive,
yeah,
pushed back strongly on that.
Well, there's an interesting piece then by Ciara Murphy, who's been writing great stuff around immigration, Oisín. And we heard during the week the general thing that people, when you ask them, completely overestimate immigration on all kinds of metrics. There's a couple of interesting new things here that I hadn't seen, which is that like there are more people in social housing that were born, more percentage in social housing born in Ireland.
The people get the facts on that totally wrong, but it certainly it builds on what we've just been talking about. So if you ask people, they think that 44% of people who have migrated to Ireland from outside Ireland are on social housing, when it's actually only 6%, compared to 9% of people who are born in Ireland who are on social housing. But they actually think 37% of people born in Ireland are on social housing. So first of all, they totally overestimate social housing, but then they think that more immigrants are there than there are. And in fact, the same is true. They presume that more Irish people are at work than migrants, yeah, who are the other way around, and they assume that we're better educated than the migrants. And again, that's not true. The migrants have higher education. So there's a lot of misperceptions. But the ERSI, in a very gentle way, because they were commissioned by the government, said it's up to politicians to do more to break down these misperceptions. And what I think what was most interesting was the thing that people got most correct was how many Ukrainians were here. And that's because there's been really good stats on that, and because our politicians have had a pretty mature debate about Ukrainians from the very beginning and about why we should be in solidarity. And so that's why I think it is not good that Simon Harris is conflating, as he has at times, IPAS with migration, because one of the figures here is it's only 12% who are non-Ukrainian asylum seekers. 50% are workers and coming for education, which, as Breed has said, we need for the hospitals, etc. So when you make it less abstract for people, they're much more likely to understand it. And our politicians have a real duty to do that, and they haven't done so far. And you
Breed,
suggested,
just briefly,
have they pivoted?
Briefly, if you will. Was it a tricky one for politicians on the left as well? Because if you look at, say, Denmark, where they have quite strict migration, right? And that is a party of the left that is doing that. But their argument is, our job is to represent working people, and this was affecting working people, so therefore we tighten up on migration. We are serving our community. We saw that Sinn Féin kind of got caught badly on this as well. Is it a difficult one? If you're in a community like yours, is it difficult to stand up for an elected rep to stand up and say to that community, migration's a good thing?
Of course it is, and it's particularly difficult in a climate of social media and bots and pylons. For example, when Georgian Kencho, whose inquest has started this week, was shot dead, I was a TD at the time, and I posted on Facebook putting a doubt into the fact that this man's life could have been saved, that he didn't have to be killed. It was just a thought I had about the whole thing and the fact that he was shot outside
his
own door.
And
I'm not going to go there. Yeah. I know you don't want me to go there, but I got 15,000 hateful posts back. Yeah. 15,000 within like a day. And when we afterwards did an analysis of it, 90% of it came from outside the state.
Okay.
90% of it came from outside Ireland, and the stuff that came from inside Ireland, a lot of it was bots. And people reading Facebook and living, and this was during COVID, and people are living in this rabbit hole, and they're seeing this, and then they think Breed Smith is the most hateful person that wants to bring on all these men killers and guys that go around with knives and attack shopkeepers. Like, this is Breed Smith's policies. So of course it's difficult in that sort of a climate. But on the other hand, it hasn't meant that the left has been wiped out because it stood up for its principles, because there's a huge, very big cohort of the Irish working class that are principally anti-racist and do not like this kind of stuff, that work alongside black bus drivers and Filipino nurses and understand that racial sentiment is very divisive and doesn't help anybody. And if we're divided, then those who control us can do anything they like to us. And that's what's happened in America. It's become a very divided country on the basis of immigration and has everybody at each other's throats. So you have Trump getting away with what he wants.
Social media. Just before we go to a break, Oisin, I think there's a lot of heavy international stuff and everything in the papers today. The most upsetting piece in the paper, bar none, is Wayne O'Connor's piece on the killing of Mason O'Connor Conway.
Yeah, so from the macro scale to the family scale, it's the story of Mason, whose stepmother was sent to jail for life imprisonment for his murder this week. And it describes what a joyful, there's a lovely description of his relationship with his grandmother, and who says he's a beautiful child, and he was cheeky and full of imagination, and he played hide and seek. And then they noticed when he was put into the care of his birth father and his stepmother that he began to lose his joy. And within 5 months, he was dead. And they have now been both convicted of either endangerment and neglect or murder. And the family are calling for increased powers for the Gardaí and for Tusla to be able to ensure they get one-on-one time with children to check their well-being. I think the complicating factor, of course, was this was during the second lockdown, apart a lot of this, five months. So it was difficult for social workers to get access.
The common element in a lot of these cases is that there was no eyes on kids who were in tricky situations.
There were doorstep conversations, but there wasn't the time that I know that social workers do get and look for with children in care in the normal course of events. So again, this was a lot of factors here, but obviously COVID was one of them.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break. Breed Smith and Larry Donnelly, Oisin Coughlan and Ellen Coyne staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. Breed Smith, Larry Donnelly, Oisin Coughlan and Ellen Coyne. Ellen, I would like to think I follow the news quite closely, right? I do not understand where we're at with the Grok story. Do you?
I don't blame you, because I suppose it's been very bamboozling for the public. First of all, because I think when people became familiar with the issues around Grok and the allegations that it is generating illegal images, either child sex abuse material most seriously or non-consensual intimate images of women, I think the public fairly would have assumed that this would be something that either the Irish government or the European Commission would move quite quickly to shut down. What we saw over the last 2 weeks was, to be honest with you, a lot of confused messaging. Initially, the government and Cumhachúna Mac we're talking about how the individuals who send the demands for these images to be generated would be the ones punished. The public were kind of saying, well, what about the actual massively powerful AI tool itself? And it was only, I suppose, from Friday when Niamh Smith, who is our minister with responsibility for AI, finally got a meeting with X after not some effort on the government's part to get in contact with them. And the news on the front page of the Business Post today that the European Commission is going to try to launch an investigation into Grok under the Digital Services Act.
So that's where it's going now, is it?
I believe so, but I suppose what is of note is that X, as Cumhachúna Mac are talking about today, have already taken 7 injunctions against our media regulator for the steps that it's trying to take to crack down on and regulate new forms of social media. And I think all this sorry episode has done is make the very strong case for these platforms not to be allowed to regulate themselves, because they clearly don't have, I think it's fair to say, the moral compass that the public would hope and expect they have. The Gardaí are now investigating 200 allegations that child sex abuse material was generated on a platform that used to be used for people to talk about politics and the Rose of Tralee and used to be an element of the public square. And I suppose people would be wondering if this was some dodgy startup that tried to create a revenge porn website, would the government be affording them the civility of trying to sit down with them and have a meeting, or would they not just be moving to try to shut it down immediately?
Breed, is any of this a surprise to you?
Well, I'm shocked by the fact that we do have an AI system that can do these things. And it's interesting that in particular, it's focused on children and women. You don't hear any mention of the nudification of men, though I'm sure that goes on. But it's the targeting of the vulnerability of people in this way. But I'm very interested because we're dealing with the papers here. The Mail on Sunday, which is not exactly my choice of reading, had a good statement in their comment, which is that deep down, citizens know that the government will not jeopardise a valuable revenue stream by taking appropriate action against the dystopian threat of Elon Musk's, the ex-owner Elon Musk. And he announced
now,
that.
Now, just to be fair, we go back to Simon Harris today. If we have a situation now where there's child sex abuse imagery circulating around the European Union, there are some things clearly more important than money. Larry,
Can I just address that? Because I was going to say it earlier on in relation to the polls around, or the book that's coming out around the polls and the elections. Simon Harris also said, we will get rid of the mechanism to control the carers allowance, what do you call it, the means testing. We'll get rid of the means test for the carers allowance. We'll pass the Occupied Territories Bill. We'll do this. Okay. These are all election promises that have been broken.
Not broken yet, all in train. You know, I know timelines have
not
shifted.
Not broken yet, but okay. it's going that direction. Okay. But he can say many things, but he hasn't acted on it. And why are they so slow to act on it?
I think the
Mail on Sunday touches something important there.
Larry, I do think it's significant that Simon Harris has said this, right? Because we have up to now probably accepted, well, these guys have all the power, etc., etc. But we all know down the years, there were people who one minute had all the power and then they are toppled like captains of industry and incredibly powerful people. Their moment passes. Is the level of outrage all over the world about this so much that actually this is the first time that Elon Musk could see consequences here?
I think we might have crossed yet another Rubicon. I think we're talking about that a lot these days. But I think this has brought this to such public attention, Grok, across the world, as you say. And I think there's been a reticence or difficulty, and Ellen references some of the complexity around the messaging. The internet and social media is kind of like the Wild West. It is very difficult in one sense to regulate. And I think I was listening to and reading Mary Akin over the week, who's an expert in the field. And she says that she's been working on these issues for decades, literally now, and that there are a multiplicity of other apps that will allow all this sorts of conduct, et cetera. Grok is the one that has brought it to people's minds. Mm-hmm. But it is extremely difficult. And what she said, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but this is going to have to be an international effort if we're going to bring this under control. Individual nations or even the European Union can't do it on their own. This is going to have to be a truly globalized effort to combat it. And I do think the sentiment is out there. But again, there is a lot of difficulty with regulating the internet.
Oisin,
I think
the piece you picked, we should say, was the Sunday Times, Gardaí order X to keep data on nudify.
And the bit of that was most scary was there was a suggestion from a man called John Donovan, who's a technologist at the Boston University's College of Communication in Massachusetts, that this might actually all be a marketing strategy by Musk, because Grok has become the most popular app.
Because in the attention economy, morality and approval of stuff has gone out the window.
What people say in public and then what they do in private, there can be a gap, and so there's a lot of people downloading Grok the app. And I heard a journalist on another radio station this morning saying that he had tried to use the Grok app itself to nudify a picture of himself this morning, and that's in Ireland, and that still happened. So the focus has been on Grok inside X, but the Grok the app itself, it still seems to be doing some of the things that we thought were
separate company X.
I know. So I do think there's a worry that I would be worried that we focus only on Grok and only on X, and then once we deal with that, we kind of move on to the next scandal when US invades Greenland. And I do think we need to look at the bigger picture. Mm. One of the issues here, is that the social media companies are not regarded as publishers, so they're not responsible for what's put on their platforms. If we said things here, RT would be in court.
Yeah, and,
same
and
for
this,
newspapers.
This was the original sin of all this.
Is.
Like, I mean, everyone knew this right from the beginning.
It's not too late to address it, though. And I think if a politician starts talking about that, that'd be something. And I heard someone from the Hope and Courage Collective this week talk as well about the recommender algorithms. So in the old days, when you joined Twitter back in 2010, you followed the people, you saw the stuff from the people you followed. And now now it chooses what you should see. And we know from all the studies that, you know, teenage girls get eating disorder stuff, and men get teenage boys get toxic masculinity stuff within minutes of accounts being set up. So we need to, by default, turn off the recommender algorithms and let people actually use them as social media as opposed to anti-social media. And I think there's, in environmentalism, there's a thing called the precautionary principle that you don't do something until you know it's safe. So at the moment, I think we should take Grok off the App Store until it proves that it's safe.
Okay, so Ellen, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday by John Lee, and this is Niamh Smith, the minister. She's the minister for AI. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd absolutely ban X if they flout Irish law. Now, I am also having trouble keeping up with Niamh Smith's various utterances and positions and reports of what went on in meetings with X and stuff as well.
Yeah, so I mean, I would be loath to ever reduce a female minister down to her gender, but I think it probably is notable that when you look at the utterances of Micheál Martin, Simon Harris and Patrick O'Donovan, Niamh Smith, in fairness to her, was a little bit stronger on this from the outset, and she sometimes went so far as to say that when she was talking about being in favour of banning X, she was nearly talking in a personal capacity. We think we do have to consider the fact that she is a woman in public life, and we saw what happened to Gráinne Seoghaire. But basically, in John Lee's story, he's going through an account of the meeting that Niamh Smith had with X on Friday. And I think two things that were notable from that. The first is John Lee is reporting X went to great lengths to try to put clear blue water between itself and Grok, which I think lacks credibility. It's also being pointed out in other papers today that it's a crime to share non-consensual intimate images. And when those images were created on a public platform like X, that was effectively sharing them. Niamh, speaking to your colleagues on Drive Time after the meeting, also said that X had basically conceded that it had hosted illegal content on its website from December 24th. And what I also picked up myself from speaking to some people familiar with the meeting on Friday, they were left unconvinced that X had done, as Oisin was outlining there, a risk assessment before this technology was let loose on the public.
Of course they had moved fast and break things.
But that's really relevant, because that would be the basis on which it would be found in breach of the Digital Services Act, which could result in massive fines being levied against X, which, to be frank, is
so
kind of the only way to get Musk's attention.
There are still old world rules for these people who exist in this new reality, boring things like a risk assessment and stuff.
Yeah, and yeah. I suppose we know that, unfortunately, and it's a very bleak way to look at things, sometimes the only way to force someone like Elon Musk to comply with what the rest of us should think should be normal rules, like don't set up the world's most mainstream, allegedly child sex abuse material factory, is to go after him financially in his pocket. And even though he is a billionaire, I think it's worth considering the fact that XAI, which is the parent AI company that generated Grok, does get billions in investment, but it's actually built on massive amounts of debt that has been taken out as well. People are talking about an AI bubble. There's huge amounts of debt that Elon Musk has taken out to build things like data centres, which are being built all over Ireland at the moment. So hitting him financially under the Digital Services Act would probably be the most efficient way to get X to listen, or AI or Grok or whatever you want to say, to the concerns of the public.
Before we leave this, back to hybrid war with America. If we were to ban X, or if we start, if Ireland is spearheading taking extreme measures against it, are we in trouble with our US overlords?
Well, I don't know if we're in trouble, but I don't think it would be a popular mood. I think it would be attacked by a lot of elements on the right who say that freedom of speech doesn't exist anymore in Europe. I think that
But when I say elements of the right, like, I mean, you're talking about the president and the vice president of America.
Exactly.
It's not just like random influencers.
Exactly. Yeah. And look, Ireland is already, as I mentioned before and I mentioned in other forums, Ireland is already in the sights of a lot of people in the American right. And I think a move like this would only draw further attention, as you say, drawing them on us, draw further attention to all this. So I think banning X would probably be a draconian step. I tend to be pro-freedom of speech. I think banning X would be a very draconian move. But I think certainly some of the CSAM and everything else is grotesque, and that needs to be stamped out.
Okay. You can't equate freedom of speech with what Grok represents.
That's what I said.
Just briefly, would you ban X?
I would, and I noticed that Trump has said in the past no state should impede the development of AI. That's a threat to anybody who tries to interfere with it.
I mentioned the Grok app rather than I wouldn't ban X, and I would also tell politicians they shouldn't delete their accounts. No one should delete their account, because what's happened then is someone else takes it up and impersonates you. Mm-hmm. So you stop using it. You say you've moved to Blue Sky or whatever else. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Don't actually delete your account.
Okay, because we did get it. Being Ireland, we managed to get into our own witch hunt about this. Of when did
people
you
should stop using
when did you off X.
But if you actually leave, you can be impersonated by some random chatbot.
Okay. Ellen, on a different note entirely, Sunday Independent, Mark Tighe, inside Ireland's most famous school.
Yeah, Mark has what I found to be a really enjoyable feature on page 8 of the Sunday Independent today. As you said, inside Ireland's most famous school. This is, of course, Wilson's Hospital School, which has found itself as the most reluctant set for one of the most vainglorious stars that the media has suffered over the last number of years, which is Enoch Burke. And the reason I enjoyed this piece is because I did find it to be a tonic, mm-hmm. in that the school was finally allowed to represent itself as what seems to be a very wholesome, happy place.
It is, isn't it?
I just think that it's kind of given the breath to talk about what it's actually like inside the school, when all we've been presented with what feels like eons now, is that same image from outside the school. And I have to say, I would be loath to kind of criticise colleagues in the media, but I do wonder if there is a public interest argument for us to stop sending journalists and camera crews to the gate of this school where children are trying to learn and parents are trying to get through the collection, just for the sake of having the same hours of footage of a very tenacious pest who has put himself in the crosshairs of the judicial system and the Gardaí.
Start ignoring him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is somebody who has a massive persecution complex, is thriving on attention, and I'm unconvinced of the public argument for public service media and newspapers like the Irish Times to give him that attention.
Yeah, and let's say on the other side of that, dealing with the profession of teaching, isn't it amazing to see how a good principal and presumably a great staff can create a tone and a culture and an atmosphere in a school that is under this kind of siege, like, but the kids there, and I presume they didn't pick out the kids who spoke to Marty. He seemed to feel, Marty's a fairly kind of straight up guy.
I don't think Mark would tolerate that.
The access was limited. But those kids seem to be really thriving in that place. It's fantastic. Breed briefly on this before we...
I don't understand Elon Musk wanting to go back to jail all the time. He mustn't like
being Enoch Burke.
Enoch Burke. The similarities there, but he mustn't like being at home because he keeps sending himself back to prison all the time. I was locked up for a defying an injunction one time, but when I got out, I didn't defy it again because I wanted to be at home.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go back to jail. But the other thing about this is in the midst of all this publicity about Elon Musk, there is a vulnerable young person out there. This is me getting old. Yeah. In the midst of all of that, there is a vulnerable young person in that school who's now in the eye of a storm. And they're vulnerable because they're identifying differently. And I believe teachers must respect that. He's saying he's not going to respect it. But in the eye of that storm, vulnerable young people are out there. And I have known parents of vulnerable young people who went through hell and back again, to the point of one person I know whose child took her own life because of the bullying over her identification, her sexual identification. There's serious implications for this. And Enoch Burke's behaviour and anybody who supports them need to think about what they're doing here, because there are vulnerable young people involved. It's not just about him.
Okay. And you know what? We don't know that young person is vulnerable because of what's going on in themselves, or vulnerable because of what's going on around them. There are plenty of young people in that situation who probably don't feel vulnerable because they feel they're getting seen and heard and the support of the people around them. We'll take a break. Breed Smith, Larry Donnelly, Oisín Coughlan and Ellen Coyne staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Breed Smith, Larry Donnelly, Oisín Coughlan, Ellen Coyne. Larry, Brenda Power is writing in the Sunday Times today, "The silence of the Hams on Iran deaths is deafening."
Yeah, I think she's making the point that a lot of voices on the left are a lot quieter about what's happening in Iran than they have been on Gaza and other places, and saying that, you know, look, this is hypocritical, because I think by any objective measure, what's happening in Iran is absolutely horrendous. I mean, in one of the newspapers today reporting that family members of a woman who was missing finally made it to where she had been buried and were told rather curtly that they had 10 minutes to stand there and cry before they had to go. It's just
of people paying to get bodies back. I saw one person claiming that they were told they had to sign a form agreeing to say publicly that their loved one was actually a member of the security forces who was attacked by rioters in order to get the body back. They seem to be extorting people to get the bodies back.
It's beyond horrible. And we're seeing now the government.
And do you agree with Brenda? Has the left been a bit muted on this?
I do. I do think so. Yeah, I do think. And we even see some elements on the left who are saying that this is down to Israelis or even American interests in Iran who are Saudis. So I do think that there is an element of hypocrisy here. But I think that the key point is what's happening in Iran is
there are a lot of elements to the protests. We'd agree. Seems to be ISIS-style stuff going on in there. There are peaceful protesters. There are ISIS-style stuff going on in there. We do know there are a lot of Mossad operating in Iran, correct?
Yeah. That's all true. But the fact is, when I look at the faces of those young people in the newspaper today, my heart goes out to their families.
Breed, is it a complicated position for the left because of the various forces involved?
Well, the history of Iran is very interesting, the modern history of Iran. In 1953, and there's a brilliant documentary called Coup 53 that is really well worth watching.
Okay.
When Mossadegh tried to nationalise the oil industry, it was mainly in the hands of BP. There was a coup organised by MI5 and the CIA.
And apparently it was one of the first times that the British Secret Service and the American Secret Service managed to actually cooperate.
They were rivals. To be privatised, just so how important the oil was and remains to these powers. And there was an amazing revolt back against them, amazing kickback against them. And it didn't just come from Islamists. It came from the working class, from the trade unionists, from the oil workers themselves, from bus drivers, from students, from teachers.
Okay, so look,
it's a real mixed bag. And there's a history of revolt.
If we accept then that a lot of the situations in the Middle East were caused by imperialism, were caused by the West, were caused by American intervention. The situation as we have it now, what's the answer?
First of all, Brenda Power is wrong about the left not caring or not having anything to say. When the Woman Life Freedom Movement happened and I was in the Dáil, I led out on that, calling it out and looking for solidarity from the Irish government. And I've become very friendly with the Iranian women here in Ireland and I still support them. And people should listen to...
Do you want the Americans to help them?
No. And neither do most of the Iranians.
But then if they're up against a repressive regime that is going to literally gun them down if they protest and revolt, what's the answer? Do we just have to let that play out until they get their way?
But I mean, it's not that you let it play out. That's why I'm saying the history of Iranian revolution is really clear. And it has been imperialist interference as well as reinstating the Shah. After the revolt where Mossadegh tried to liberate the oil companies and bring them back into public control.
Okay, the Shah's son now
is saying, I'll come in and save you. And the Americans are pushing this and the Israelis
are
pushing
Americans are not. Trump is standing back from him so far. And also he is saying, in fairness, he'd be an interim leader for people to galvanise around.
Yeah.
He's saying right now anyway, he's not trying to bring back the monarchy. The point I want to get at though is the
Shah's hands were steeped in blood.
Okay.
Anybody who interfered in Iran had their hands steeped in blood. But it is possible
It
is possible for the Iranian people to have a revolution if imperialism stays outside, leaves them alone, let them decide their own destiny.
They started trying to have a revolution and it's been quelled by complete massacre and brutality of the worst kind. Not just killing people, they're shooting people deliberately in the eyes. But look what they did in Gaza.
Look what the Israelis did in Gaza. There is brutality all over the world. And the Gaza brutality, but two wrongs don't make a right.
But how do we help the people? Everyone agrees the Iranian people should decide how they live and what the future of Iran is.
So don't send in troops. Don't let Trump bomb it.
How can we help them?
And don't let the CIA or anybody else
organise a coup. How can we help them or does the world stand by?
Leave them to their own devices and give them solidarity where you can.
But hang on, solidarity, like we gave them solidarity this week and we're up to, we don't know, thousands of them, maybe tens of thousands of them were massacred. We just stand by and let that play out.
I
understand the difficulty of American intervention, but is there any middle ground here?
The women here from Iran that live here have handed in letters to the TDs to the, in the Dáil this week. I received one of them.
A strongly worded letter to
I want to tell you what they're asking for. What they're asking for is that we use every diplomatic weapon we have to isolate the Iranian regime, number one.
Sanctions.
And number two, that we expel the Iranian ambassador, not just call him in or her in, but expel them. And number three, they're asking for the EU to take up serious sanctions. Now, on top
sanctions
of that, we would also say on the left, hands off Iran.
Okay.
The West
Larry,
should
briefly,
not go in
I'm
and
nearly
interfere.
Out of time.
Yeah, I just don't see where that goes. I just don't see. I see suffering. I don't see how we get out of it by virtue of strongly worded letters. I think stronger action is necessary. And I do take the point about U.S. interventionism.
I'm not saying the letters are strong enough.
But there needs to be some sort of concerted action. How can we stand? The suffering is just horrendous.
Okay.
The letters have asked us to do more than just write letters.
I think you've made that point. Yeah, I get you, Breed. Okay. I was probably unfair there in dismissing strongly worded letters, because your point was this is what they're telling us what they want, and they need to be the ones to tell us what they want. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much to my excellent panel this morning. Breed Smith, Larry Donnelly, Oisin Coughlan and Ellen Coyne, setting the world to rights. And just after 12 noon now, we'll go to the newsroom.